I think it's a tension that happens in a lot of organizing where people are incarcerated, because you can't necessarily talk to them and they don't have a kind of the power to like speak publicly necessarily. And that for me makes it all the more important to honor and talk to detainees or people who are incarcerated and treat them as political agents and follow the kind of political strategies that they actually want to follow. Sometimes it's not what you think you would want to do, but it's really important.
Welcome to Kiteline, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach, and we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on Kiteline, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
Before we get started with this week's theme, we want to share some prison-related news. We have an update on Monica Caballero and Francisco Solar, whose statement was featured on Kiteline episode 18. They've been freed from Spanish prisons and expelled to Chile. Welcome back.
According to the Washington Post and the LA Times, in 2014, a lawsuit against the GEO Group, the country's second largest private prison company, claimed that tens of thousands of immigrants detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, were forced to work for a dollar a day or no pay at all in violation of federal anti-slavery laws. In the first week of March 2017, a federal judge ruled that the lawsuit could become a class action suit. As a result, the suit could involve as many as 60,000 detained immigrants. This is the first class action suit against a private U.S. prison company for forced labor. At the Denver Contract Detention Facility, which the GEO Group owns and operates under contract with ICE, detainees work for up to 8 hours per day, 40 hours per week, cleaning bathrooms, showers, toilets, windows, detainees' rooms, and staff offices. They also wax floors and prepare and serve meals, all under the threat of solitary confinement.
Muncie, Indiana resident William E. Barnhouse was recently exonerated after serving 24 years of an 80-year sentence for a crime he didn't commit. In 1992, Barnhouse was convicted of rape and criminal deviant conduct, but recent DNA tests prove that he didn't commit the crime. Judge Kimberly Dowling granted a joint motion to exonerate Barnhouse. The motion was offered by local prosecutors and lawyers from the Innocence Project, a nonprofit organization that's exonerated over 300 convicted felons with DNA tests. Barnhouse's troubles aren't over. Two prosecutors in the case are considering whether to try Barnhouse a second time. That trial is scheduled for June 26th. Meanwhile, Judge Dowling, acknowledging Barnhouse's lifelong history of mental illness, granted a motion for him to be released for evaluation and treatment at an Indianapolis mental health facility. According to one of his attorneys, Barnhouse never gave up hope that the truth would prevail.
Nonprofit publication Truth Out reports that mothers who become incarcerated face a form of, quote, double punishment, unquote. In addition to being separated from their families during their time behind bars, many women face difficult legal battles to regain custody of their children even after having been released. Truth Out reports that approximately 2.7 million children under the age of 18, or more than 3.6% of children in the United States, currently have a parent behind bars. More than 5 million have had a parent incarcerated at some point in their lives. In Washington alone, 109,000 children, or 7% of the state's children, had experienced parental incarceration between 2011 and 2012. Additionally, a significant percentage of children who enter the child welfare or foster care systems do so as a result of a parent's incarceration. Federal legislation creates even more barriers for incarcerated mothers to reunite with their children after prison. Under the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, or ASFA, passed in 1997, quote, if a child is in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, state agencies are required to begin proceedings to terminate parental rights, unquote. In addition to recognizing the political problems with these systems, many advocates and support communities are strongly critical of the assumption that incarceration renders mothers or fathers unfit to parent.
A subsidiary of the Italian post office, Air Mistral, is involved in deportations of imprisoned refugees by shipping them out of Italy. In response, masked individuals demolished a branch of the post office with sledgehammers in solidarity with those refugees.
On March 1st, 2017, the Movement for Black Lives Coalition announced a new popular education curriculum titled Transformative Bail Reform. The publication emerged from, quote, a convening of over 20 Black-led base-building organizations who came together to discuss the implications of bail and bail reform on Black communities across the country, unquote. The curriculum thinks critically about the socio-political mechanism of using bail as collateral for an individual's freedom and how that may play into state-sponsored oppression. The authors of the curriculum explain that, quote, we cannot enact reforms that move our communities closer to liberation without a historically grounded understanding of the inherent anti-Blackness of our criminal punishment system and an exploration of how many proposed reforms continue to re-entrench oppression and to prioritize profit over people. We therefore advocate for reforms that shift state resources away from punitive and ineffective systems and reallocate the trillions of dollars currently wasted on criminalizing our people to community-controlled and accountable alternatives that respect the dignity and humanity of all people, unquote. For more information or to download your own copy of Transformative Bail Reform, visit the Movement for Black Lives website at policy.m4bl.org.
Last episode, Aaron Azura gave us an introduction to the history of colonialism in Australia, including racist measures to control non-white immigration, and later in the 1980s, the introduction of mandatory detention for refugees. He told us about the protests by refugees inside the detention centers and the launch of a protest camp outside one remote and brutal center, Woomera. Today, Aaron recounts the story of the mass breakout from Woomera and its aftermath. We'll finish our coverage of Woomera next episode, almost 15 years to the day after the protest camp and escape. Here's Aaron.
I think that for some of the people who attended, they were excited about being there, but they weren't that interested in following the lead of the detainees. But for a lot of us, the idea was to work with detainees to facilitate them to protest. So people had been on the phone with detainees inside, and some of the detainees told us that they were going to do an action at a particular time. I think it was 5 or 6 p.m. on Easter Friday. And it's funny that even though the whole protest was totally secular, the idea of it being at Easter and happening, it kind of gave the whole event some kind of weird symbolism, such that I'm still talking about Easter Friday, which seems bizarre. So they told us that they were doing a protest, and a protest inside would look like people breaking out of the various different kinds of compounds that they were placed in and going out into the main part of the detention center that was closer to the outside. And it was surrounded by really high fences, really very structurally sound metal fences with a lot of razor wire at the top. There was a kind of inner perimeter fence and then a couple of other outer perimeter fences. So people went to meet. And at first, I think that a lot of people thought that we weren't going to be able to get more than maybe a kilometer or 500 meters close to the detention center. But as people started to come and people started to kind of walk over, people reached the first outer perimeter fence and started shaking it. And I think it was over 3 or 4 meters high, but it basically came down within 10 minutes. And this is kind of signal to the fact that this was so in such a remote environment that I think the state hadn't actually realized that people would be able to kind of do this. They hadn't imagined what could happen if 2,000 people descended and started pulling down the fence. So we got to this first fence, pulled it down, and then people started running towards the kind of inner fence. There was another perimeter fence that we thought we were going to have to pull down as well, but it turned out to have a huge gap in it, like a gate. And then eventually we're right on the inner perimeter fence, and the protesters were, I guess, like 2 meters away, 3 meters away on the other side of another high fence. And this is, you know, this is like a jail. It's huge metal bars. Obviously, some of them had organized metal bars to try to start bringing that fence down. And people from within the protesters had brought wire cutters. And so a lot of people started trying to cut the wires or lever open some of the bars on the fence. We were expecting a huge police presence, but there weren't enough people. And it turned out that something in the protesters' favor was that there was a kind of debate happening between the state police, who had jurisdiction over the outside of the center, and the Australian Federal Police, who had jurisdiction over the inside of the center. And at the time, in South Australia, the state, it was a Labor government, and they were critical of mandatory detention policies. So they had basically said, well, yes, you know, we'll send in police, but we can't say how many we're sending. We're not quite sure, you know, when the Australian Federal Police have to kind of be responsible for whatever happens at this protest. So that really worked, because the police presence for a while anyway, until people started breaking out, was pretty minimal. It's kind of emotional to retell, because this is a moment when, you know, when you're involved in organizing a protest and you feel strongly about something and you know that, you know, people are really in trouble and you care about them, you want to be able to talk to them. But I think for a lot of people, this was the first time that they'd ever been able to come face-to-face with a detainee or any detainees. People had brought flowers to give them. There were a lot of kind of big visual things, like banners, ribbons to pass through the fence. There were sound actions, so there was a lot of music. There were organized people with sound systems on trucks who came. And for a while, I guess for maybe about 15 minutes, it's hard to remember exactly what the time was. Maybe it was even an hour. A lot of people were just talking, shouting back and forth. And the detainees who were kind of on the other side of this perimeter fence started crossing that fence and coming like really close to us. And so there were just like, I guess maybe like 6 inches of bars between us. And then as the people who were trying to actually bring the fence down or open gaps in it started to be successful, there was a huge crowd. There was a lot of excitement. There are a lot of people who are crying on both sides. There's a couple of films that you can watch on YouTube if you want to find out more. But it was just this intense moment of joy and kind of unexpected connection and real grief for these people who are locked up, who we just wanted to be free. Eventually, the people on the inside and the people on the outside levered one bar off, and it was enough to allow people to jump through, and they started just jumping out. It was about, I think, 48 people who escaped. And at that point, the cops came. A whole posse of cops from either side started coming in and trying to tackle detainees who had escaped, tackle protesters who were helping them. There were a lot of scuffles. Australian police at the time weren't armed with guns, and nobody expected them to use them. So there was a lot of attempts at de-arresting happening. So people who were actually tackling police officers and trying to free detainees or free protesters were being arrested. The other thing that was weird was that the mainstream media were there, and they were trying to film. And to protect people's identity, lots of us were trying to block the cameras of mainstream media. We weren't trying to block people who were filming for indie media or who were independently there, which in retrospect is kind of bizarre, but we definitely were trying to block the major news networks from filming what was happening. And then the urgent thing that became clear was that we had to get detainees who had escaped back to camp, where there were a huge number of tents, where there was cover, where we could hide them. So people started basically running with detainees back to camp. And that night, that happened around 5 or 6 p.m. And then that night, throughout the night, the police were raiding various tents. There were people who were surrounding detainees. There were protesters who were dressing up as detainees and trying to kind of get arrested themselves. And then there were attempts also to, because by this time the police had surrounded the camp, there were attempts to start spiriting detainees out in cars. In retrospect, a lot of it was, I mean, one of the things that I remember most clearly is that about 3 Afghani detainees were in our camp, in the kind of camp that I was in, and we made them tea and gave them food. And we sat down and talked. The really important thing was just to connect and to ask them what has happened to them, what their history was. I was talking to a detainee who was from Iran, who had been a political prisoner in Iran, who decided to leave because he thought that he would be disappeared, basically. In Australia, his asylum claim was denied, and he'd been in detention for 5 years without any kind of answer about if he could even go back to Iran. So that was a really huge part of it, was in this moment of freedom, and it was temporary for a lot of the people. Of the 48 detainees who broke out, 36 were arrested again, and they ended up having criminal trials and being given prison terms. And it seems like that wouldn't be a desirable thing, but for a lot of the detainees, actually being in a prison was preferable to being in a detention center. So some of them ended up serving prison terms in Australian prisons, where they actually had more rights or more kind of capacity to organize or just be people than what they had had in detention centers. I want to talk about the aftermath of the breakout now. I think that while some people who had attended really intended for people to escape and thought of the protest itself as a way to make that happen, the majority of people present had thought of it as a symbolic protest and had thought of it as the extent of it as being just making our presence felt at the detention center, maybe from a distance, but just being there. And a lot of people, even those of us who had been organizing it from the beginning, hadn't really given a lot of thought to what would happen in the event of a breakout. So I think that in general, the protest camp itself was really disorganized. And that's something that people learned from right away and did differently the next time. But also because it was a spokes council model where everybody got to talk, but there wasn't a consensus, there were a lot of groups who were more on the liberal end of things that were worried that having detainees escape would make us look bad and would result in really negative media coverage. So one socialist group in particular, at the next day's big spokes council meeting, they said that they thought that we should give back the detainees to the police. No one was actually willing to do that. So they were shouted down pretty fast. But it was also decided, because there were still detainees in camp, because the situation was really unstable, we didn't know what the police would do, was that the actions that we would take wouldn't be focused on trying to make another breakout happen, but that we would basically have a day where things were a little bit kind of more laid back. And also on that day after the breakout happened, there was a lot of liaison with Indigenous owners who had just arrived, who were representing the Indigenous nation that kind of has jurisdiction over Woomera itself. And there was one particular Indigenous activist who arrived. We had a really great meeting about immigration and Indigenous sovereignty, but she was really worried, especially about detainees who had decided to hike into the desert, because she felt, as a kind of Indigenous representative of the land, and it's really, you know, it's really remote, it's pretty hard for anyone to survive without water, without food. If you're hiking in the desert, she was worried for their safety and felt accountable for what might happen to them if they got lost. So she was also urging us that we should maybe think about giving detainees to the police. And there was a really difficult conversation where basically, you know, a lot of people at the protests who were listening to this were saying, well, yes, we recognize Indigenous sovereignty, but there's a way in which we also need to listen to the detainees who have been locked up and what do they want to do, and we need to kind of follow their lead. So this was, you know, this is a moment of tension, I think, between immigration activism and Indigenous activism that really showed up the kind of tensions and contradictions between these two, and this is a kind of tension that never really got resolved. The detainees didn't end up wanting to be handed back to the police, and the majority, and those who are still in camp, I think eventually 12 managed to escape, mostly in cars. The people who ended up hiking through the desert, because there was very little cover in the desert, also ended up being picked up by police, because the police had helicopters. The rest of the weekend was basically trying to kind of keep the camp happening and then also do jail solidarity with the detainees who'd been arrested again and with a number of protesters who were arrested. So there were about 30 people who were arrested during the breakout and then other people who were arrested over the course of the weekend. And the camp basically ended up winding up when people had to return to Adelaide, which is the nearest major city, to do jail solidarity and attend the court hearings, initial court hearings of people who had been detainees, who'd broken out, and protesters who were being charged. So after that, there was maybe a week or so where people were doing jail solidarity, and then in the main, a lot of the protesters were released without charge, but all of the detainees were remanded. And then it also ended up being a kind of a lot of arguments with the human rights groups and lawyers who had been overseeing people's asylum claims, arguing that they had basically been misled by protesters, by kind of, you know, provocateur anarchists, and using that strategically to kind of argue that the detainees didn't know what they were doing. And that also kind of sheds light on a really major contradiction or tension within immigration activism in Australia, and I also noticed it happening in the U.S., which is how to deal with the agency of immigration detainees and the question of whether they're understood as having political agency or being political, or whether they're understood as complete victims who aren't able to decide for themselves what they want or to kind of decide on political strategy. And that's, I think it's a tension that happens in a lot of organizing where people are incarcerated because you can't necessarily talk to them and they don't have a kind of the power to like speak publicly necessarily. And that for me makes it all the more important to honor and talk to detainees or people who are incarcerated and treat them as political agents and follow the kind of political strategies that they actually want to follow. Sometimes it's not what you think you would want to do, but it's really important because the whole question of incarceration, if it's immigration detention or prisons or jails, is that people who are incarcerated are not understood as people. And they're not understood as people with agency or with kind of rationality or decision-making power. They're understood as criminals who are kind of subhuman. So in that respect, at least the people that I was organizing with or the kind of affinity groups that I was organizing with within the larger coalition really pushed back on these legal strategies, who were saying, oh, they didn't know what they were doing, they were misled. Anarchist activists convinced them that they should try to escape. They didn't. And in a way, part of it also was speaking back to this racializing discourse around how detainees, I mean, detainees, all the detainees are people of color, and a lot of them are Muslim, right? So there's this discourse that was happening in Australia at the time and still is of detainees being barbaric somehow and inhuman in the sense that they were willing to do terrible things to themselves to make a political point, like lip sewing, which was understood as a kind of barbarism or as a kind of a form of terrorism. And one of the ways that, you know, following detainees' lead was to really undercut that. And I think part of it, there's a danger in investing in a kind of humanist narrative where you're saying, no, these people are human. But it seemed really important to me, and it still does, that people who are incarcerated and people of color who are incarcerated, because all the kinds of carceral logics that put them there are about their racialization, not human or not human enough or kind of criminal or barbaric, that you cut through those narratives and say, okay, this is, you guys are political agents here. You guys are leading. What do you want? What do you need? How can we be in solidarity with you? So that was Wimmera 2002. There's some things to say about what happened after that. In the short term, within 6 months, Wimmera Detention Center itself was closed, and the Australian government opened a new detention center in South Australia, which was slightly less remote, but that had much, much better technologies of enclosure. So that was Baxter Detention Center. It had much improved fortifications, including a massive electric fence. And at that point, people started to realize that breaking people out, like we'd done, would not necessarily be possible again.
Thanks again to Aaron for taking the time to tell us about these experiences. We'll finish this conversation about Wimmera and its aftermath in the next episode and hope you'll join us. This has been Kiteline. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, Kiteline Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. Kiteline wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512. Or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on Kiteline at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Kiteline is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been Kiteline. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening.